I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of February. This hour, Justice Antonin Scalia, his legacy and the way forward in nominating and confirming a new justice to replace him. We'll have three guests with us during the course of this hour. One of our guests has said his legacy is so large and complex that it will take weeks simply to catalog the questions that he leaves behind. Another of our guests says he will go down in history as one of the most quotable justices, but not the one with the deepest impact. And a third guest will tell us about the political lines that have been drawn and how difficult it will be to nominate a successor and to get that confirmed by the Senate. So it should be a very interesting hour, and we'll welcome your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Robert Shapiro, one of our guests, Dean and Professor of Law at Emory University. He clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice John Paul Stevens during Scalia's tenure, and he says that he has memories, and we'll hear some of those this hour, of Scalia's dynamic interaction with clerks. Professor Shapiro, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Also joining us is Garrett Epps, and Garrett has an article for The Atlantic, Justice Scalia's Outsized Legacy, a passionate, complex conservative who forever changed how Americans think about original text. Garrett is a contributing editor for The Atlantic. He teaches constitutional law and creative writing for law students at the University of Baltimore. His latest book is American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. Garrett, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it should be an interesting hour. Professor Shapiro, let's start with you, because not too many have memories of Scalia's dynamic interaction with clerks. You were one of them. What was the dynamic interaction?
Justice Scalia was somebody who always enjoyed argument with whoever it was. The interactions of justices and clerks tend to take place in fairly formalized settings. Would go out to lunch once a year or sometimes see each other at receptions. And with other justices, it was often more about pleasantries and just polite small talk. But it was clear that Justice Scalia liked to argue, and he welcomed other clerks arguing with him, talking about cases, talking about ideas. It was clear that he reveled in that argumentative process.
Mm-hmm. Did you like that as well?
Yes, very much. It was very refreshing, although also somewhat intimidating to be in that kind of colloquy with a Supreme Court justice.
I would imagine. We keep hearing phrases about his huge intellect, Garrett. Was he a really, really smart man?
I think he was clearly smart as to details, had enormous erudition, was terribly quick, could make comparisons across contexts. There could be some debate about the extent to which his overarching vision really was an overarching vision, but I don't think anybody ever doubted his intelligence.
And you have said in your article, his legacy is so large and complex, it will take weeks to catalog the questions that he leaves behind. Why is the legacy so large? What makes you say that?
Well, I think his opinions and his published writing had a huge impact on how lawyers argue and courts consider both constitutional questions on the one hand and statutory questions on the other hand. He was fascinated by statutory construction. His background was in administrative law. And so he is writing, very original and sort of demanding texts in both areas that even if people don't agree with them, even if they don't show up in the finished opinion, lawyers have to take account of when they're framing their arguments in front of courts. And then secondly, he had huge impact on different areas of substantive law. For example, most of our quarrels about religious freedom, going back to Hobby Lobby and coming forward to this term, really are kind of footnotes to his opinion in Employment Division versus Smith in 1990, which did didn't even make the top 10 list in most of the obituaries, and yet it overturned this huge area of law.
Mm-hmm. Both of you have talked about his embracing originalism, the Constitution interpreted by reference to its meaning at the time of its adoption. How do you determine that? I mean, do you look at things other than the Constitution? Do you read other things that the founding fathers wrote about? How do you determine that? Professor Shapiro, you first.
Sure. Well, I think that there are a number of indicia that people look to. I'll have to say one of the big issues with originalism is how do you really know what the meaning was at the time? I think one could look to judicial decisions at the time, public discourse at the time, and certainly Justice Scalia emphasized we're not looking at the private thoughts of individual framers, but trying to get a sense of what the public understanding was at the time. But it is certainly an issue is to try to figure out what that is. That's something that's often very difficult for historians to do and for justices as well. And a related issue really is at what level of generality one should understand that. So if the framers of the 14th Amendment talked about equal protection and they had certain views personally about school desegregation, how should one understand that? Should one look at what equal protection meant in general, or should one look at its specific application to cases at that time?
Mm-hmm. And Garrett, how did he look at the Second Amendment? That was a pretty big decision that was made on right to own handguns. How did he interpret the Second Amendment that way?
Well, I think that although it may be his biggest decision, the decision in District of Columbia versus Heller won't be remembered as his best work, because in essence, just to back up a little, to the extent that Justice Scalia's originalist method had some merit, it was based on text. He would bring in founding era dictionaries, legal works, and so forth to try to figure out what the meaning of terms like due process was, and that's a very worthwhile activity. That's not what he did in Heller. In Heller, he basically assumed that there was an individual right to bear arms and then went through a lot of historical material and said none of this disproves. In other words, he put the burden, I think, in the wrong place. And Marcia Coyle records in her book, The Roberts Court, that when a brief from historians came in that gave historical evidence that the Second Amendment did not mean an individual right, he dismissed it. He said, well, historians have their own point of view. They're just grinding their axe. I don't think that's really a principled approach to so-called original understanding, and I think that the outrage that greeted that decision is somewhat justified.
Mm-hmm. Professor Robert Shapiro, what were his most influential, maybe he wrote the majority opinion, he didn't write all that many, but most influential decisions that were made with his full support while he was on the court?
Certainly. Well, I think if you think about areas of the law, we talked about originalism, and Garrett mentioned his approach to statutory interpretation as well. So I think there are several areas of the law where his approach has been extremely important and will continue to have long-term impact. Garrett mentioned the area of religious liberty and his approach to that, beginning with Employment Division versus Smith. He also had a particular approach to matters of having juries decide disputed issues of fact, which has been tremendously significant in the criminal justice area, particularly with regard to sentencing. He had particular ideas about what it meant to confront adverse witnesses and how that constitutional right is understood, which has had important impact in the area of evidence. And in some technical areas about things like when individuals can sue to enforce statutes, call them private rights of action, his views also dramatically diminished the ability of individuals to bring those kinds of lawsuits. So I think across those broad array of areas, his jurisprudence certainly will have lasting impact.
Mm-hmm. There are certain things that have made a lot of press the last couple of days, Garrett. One is his views of the anti-gay sodomy laws in 2003, his dissent. Many Americans don't want persons who openly engage in homosexual conduct as partners in their business, as scoutmasters for their children, probably very carefully chosen words, as teachers in their children's schools, or as boarders in their home.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary piece of rhetoric that Justice Scalia threw in. He was dissenting in a case in which the court held that states could not basically make it a crime to engage in homosexual sex, and he was protesting that this was striking at the very moral foundations of law. And then he put that in, I think, knowing, and he was very good at this, knowing that it would be picked up and quoted in the press and read by people who weren't lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Representative Barney Frank not too long ago said, the man is a bigot. And he was talking about that that quote, among other things. It really was almost shocking in the way it evoked the idea of gays and lesbians as child molesters or as people who would be in your home and menace you. It was not called for, and it was really inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Shapiro, you write about what he said about the majority opinion by Anthony Kennedy. If I ever joined an opinion with that kind of language, I would hide my head in a bag.
Yes, that's right. He was certainly, I think, fairly extraordinary at times in his willingness to be fairly acerbic in his dissents, commenting, as is clear from that, both on the substance of what his colleagues wrote and also sometimes the style as well. So I think particularly in that case, the case having to do with the right to same-sex marriage, there was a certain amount of frustration on his part, given his views that you were discussing with Garrett Epps about the area of gay rights in general, and to see how that came out. But yes, he had an unusually strong tone in his opinions.
And what about the other justices? I'm wondering how he got along with Kennedy. We've read a lot about the friendship with Sotomayor and certainly with Ginsburg. Did they just sort of say if they didn't agree with him, oh, there he goes again. He says it beautifully. I really disagree with what he says, but he sure can say it well.
Robert, you know more than I do.
Right. Well, I think certainly it's clear that Justice Scalia had a charming, engaging style, which in general I think the other justices certainly appreciated. It's also true that the justices tend to disagree with each other on a variety of different cases, but there's a strong institutional commitment to getting along well with each other. Having said that, I just don't know. I mean, given the strong nature of his comments with regard, say, to Justice Kennedy, or in an earlier time with regard to Justice O'Connor, I have to wonder whether the extremely strong and somewhat dismissive tone that he took in some of his opinions might have had some impact beyond the opinions themselves on their relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Garrett, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think a lot of observers think that his being willing to attack people who, you know, if you agreed with him 99%, you were the enemy, in essence, and it may have limited his ability to become a true leader in the conservative bloc.
Mm-hmm. Although he did outside the court, would you say? Became a leader in the conservative bloc?
Oh, outside the court, he was a hero to the conservative movement. There's no question about it. But being a leader within the court is a different question, and I think he had his vote and he had his influence, but I think that the other justices intellectually were a little wary of him.
Mm-hmm. You write in your article in The Atlantic that when asked in 1996 about the legacy of the great liberal Justice William Brennan, he said he is probably the most influential justice of the century. And you talk about Brennan being a man of charm to liberals and conservatives alike, but looking at Scalia, he was a man of, how would you describe him?
Well, I think he was a man of personal charm, but in terms of building political coalitions, you know, Bill Brennan was famous for sort of, you know, taking people by the arm and saying, what do I have to do to get your vote? He once threw his arms around Harry Blackmun, who was quite conservative, and said, oh, Harry, us liberals have to stick together, you know, and eventually influenced, I think, Blackmun's view of himself. Scalia didn't do that, and this court doesn't lend itself very much to that. His opinions spoke for him, and to the extent that they were off-putting, I think there was no sort of behind-the-scenes politicking to fix that. Now, that having said, it's perfectly clear if you sit in the court that the nine members of this particular court like each other just fine. There isn't, you know, horrible hatred seething underneath the surface.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what has been so important a case and what Scalia's views were on this, Professor Robert Shapiro, Citizens United case in 2010.
Yes, well, I think Citizens United is an example where this court was certainly willing to overturn a longstanding precedent to instantiate what it saw as the better view of the Constitution, particularly in the area of the First Amendment, but other areas as well. I think this has been a court that said if we think that there's been prior decisions with which we disagree, then it's time to overrule those. And that way, I think I've said that Justice Scalia represented that kind of new judicial conservatism. I think back in the 60s and 70s, one thought of a judicial conservative as somebody who was respectful of precedent, unwilling to overturn prior decisions, tended to be quite deferential to the legislature, not wanting to strike down laws. And I think what you see in Citizens United is a little more of the new judicial conservatism, which Justice Scalia embodied, where if he thinks that the court has gotten it wrong and gotten it wrong for a very long time, well, it's time to put a stop to that, and so willing to strike down laws that he thought did not accord with his view of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And one of the laws... I'm sorry, go ahead, Garrett.
Well, I was going to say, Citizens United also showed some of the limits of the originalist method, because Justice Stevens, in his dissent, wrote a great deal about the original understanding and said, I can't believe that the framers wanted corporations to have these free speech rights. The framers disliked corporations. And he quoted a great deal of material from the framers saying the corporate form is a danger and so forth. And Scalia's answer to that was, he said, well, yes, they may have thought that, but that's because they didn't understand that corporations really aren't monopolies. And if they had understood that, they would have agreed with me. And, you know, which we called the, you know, I knew the framers, I worked with the framers.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, he was not above kind of, originalism took him only so far, and he was not above jumping the rest of the distance.
Yeah, and well, let's go to phone calls, and then I'll have more questions down the road here. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. The first part of our program today, we have two guests with us. Garrett Epps, contributing editor for The Atlantic, teaches constitutional law and creative writing for law students at the University of Baltimore, and is the author of American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. Robert Shapiro, Dean of Emory Law School, previously Associate Vice Provost for Academic Affairs for Emory and co-director of the Emory Law Center on Federalism and Inter-Systemic Governance. And we're welcoming phone calls. We have a couple lines open for you at this moment, so feel free to join the conversation later in the hour. There's been a whole lot of to-do about whether or not the president should nominate a replacement and the Republican opposition, and whether or not there will even be a hearing and who a good candidate might be. So let's hold those thoughts till the last part of our show when a guest will address them. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always welcome your comments, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Paul in DeForest is our first caller. Gentlemen, hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about something that you just brought up about the stated intent of Justice Scalia to defer to the legislative body. Yet, in the famous voting rights case, he was quoted in argument at scoffing at the near unanimous actions by both the Senate and the House to keep the Voting Rights Act in place. Clearly, the intent of the national legislature to maintain it, and yet he overturned it. I cannot understand how he could so verbally and openly go against something and actually place the judicial, argument in front of the legislature.
Garrett, you want to start?
Well, I think you have to understand that with Justice Scalia's threnodies to the legislative power and how wonderful it was, were kind of split. He loved state legislatures, and he wanted the states to have enormous amounts of power in various ways. He had nothing but contempt for Congress. It really was extraordinary to watch him talk about Congress. I was there when he made the comment that the caller talks about, and his lip would curl. You know, he would say, "Oh, I'm sure every member of Congress read this record," you know, because the lawyer cited the record that Congress compelled, basically saying they don't know. He said they don't know what they're voting. It's just some staff person puts it in front of them. And it was really a very extraordinary way to talk about a co-equal branch of the government, and really did call into question his commitment to his stated methodology.
What are your thoughts on that, Professor Shapiro? That's interesting. A contempt for Congress?
Absolutely. I think Paul's question touches on just that point. I think there had been other justices in other times who made it a centerpiece of their approach to, whenever possible, defer to the legislature, to think that judges had a smaller role to play in not overruling statutes unless absolutely necessary. I don't think that was the approach of Justice Scalia at all. I think, as Garrett mentioned, he certainly didn't evince respect for Congress in his opinions or his comments at oral argument. I think he thought when the Constitution said something, then that's what he was going to follow, and did not have particular confidence or faith that the national legislature was going to do its duty in trying to obey the Constitution itself.
But state legislators were on top of their game? They were reading everything, Garrett?
Well, no, I think he just had this reverence for states as bodies. Just said the states. In the Arizona versus United States immigration case, he went on and on about how Arizona disagrees with the federal government. Arizona has the privilege. And the states had a kind of mystical significance for him. And, of course, if you look at his resume, he never had any experience with a state legislature. That might have changed his mind from my own experience.
Paul, thanks very much for the call. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Great program and a fitting tribute to a recently deceased, memorable justice. I'm wondering if members of your panel would care to comment on the idea, speaking of originalism, Mitch McConnell's idea that the president should wait approximately 1 year, or we should wait as a country approximately 1 year until the naming of a nominee for the vacancy on the court. I'm wondering if any of your expert guests would hazard a guess as to what Anton Scalia would say about that particular reading of that clause of the Constitution, that it's appropriate to kind of hamstring the court for about a year until a new president is elected.
Professor Shapiro, I want to hear both your thoughts, but we'll start with you, Robert.
Well, I think it's this is a kind of issue which the Constitution sets the framework for, about the president shall nominate and by and with the consent of the Senate shall appoint. And I think Justice Scalia would see that that's the framework the Constitution sets in place. And then there's a political process that takes place within those bounds. I think he's someone who understood that there were some questions which were political questions rather than constitutional questions. And so while it's also true that he seemed to be very concerned about whether the president was not doing the president's duty when it came to enforcing the law, I think he might well recognize that there are some areas that are really more political areas than questions where the Constitution gives definitive answers.
Garrett?
Well, I saw Justice Scalia speak very shortly after he was confirmed, somebody asked him from the audience, you know, what do you think is the Senate's proper role in the confirmation process? And he kind of looked at this person and said, it's whatever the Senate wants it to be. So I think he might have had some sympathy with the idea that it's the job of the president to nominate. The Constitution says shall nominate. But I think if Congress wanted to misbehave, he would probably figure there's nothing in the Constitution that stops it from misbehaving. And, of course, it couldn't have lowered his opinion of Congress, so that's not a problem either.
Rich, thanks for the call. Peter in Baraboo, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking the call.
Sure.
I want to go back to the same-sex marriage issue and the question of, quote, morality, unquote, which Justice Scalia may have felt very strongly about, but it certainly was unethical. And I believe that a lot of the stretching on the part of not just Justice Scalia, but people in general around the difference between morality and ethics is something that we really need to help focus on. Because one can be very moral and unethical, and one can be very unethical and moral. And I'll take my answer off the phone, but I really do appreciate the conversation.
Thanks
so much.
Peter. Thank you. Garrett, you want to start?
Well, the difference between morals and ethics is sort of beyond my remit. I've read some moral philosophy, but I would not attempt to repeat it. I think that there is a question that every lawyer recognizes when you say the role of morality in law. And that is the question is, to what extent can a community reflect certain moral judgments, like the judgments that Justice Scalia clearly shared, that, as he said in one of his opinions, homosexual conduct is dangerous and immoral. To what extent can a community reflect that in the law just because that's their moral belief, without having to say we're also going to justify it on the basis of some harm to people? And Justice Scalia came down very much on the side that society and the majority has a right to embody its moral judgments in law, that is not the business of the Congress to look, I mean of the court, to look behind those moral judgments. And he went through quite a list of various kinds of laws that were going to be threatened by the principles of Lawrence versus Texas. Just said basically, you know, this is collapsing the very civilization, the very foundations of Western law. I think lawyers understood what he was saying, whether we agree or not. It's an ongoing question. It's not settled with his death, that's for sure.
Yeah. Could we talk just a little bit about religion, Professor Shapiro? I found it interesting. I didn't know that he went out of his way. I read somewhere, I assume it was an authoritative voice, that he really hated Vatican II and went out of his way to hear the Mass in Latin. Obviously, he was a very conservative Catholic, and it seems to me if you're that conservative, I wonder, you know, we're supposed to have this division. Did Catholicism, did his religion influence his many votes on so-called morality issues?
I think it's always difficult to say the connection between somebody's personal views about morality or religion and how they vote. I think it seems that in many cases, Justice Scalia's view of the law did align with his understanding of the dictates of his religion, but not all. And anything actually picking up on the prior question to which Peter asked and Garrett was addressing, I mean, I think that's an area where certainly the morality of the law, which I think did perhaps align with his religious upbringing, was an area which he felt strongly, which really the court, I think, moved away from his position. I think he was someone who was certainly willing to say, in general, it's fine for legislature to say, we find this conduct immoral, and therefore we can criminalize it. Whereas we see the court now being a little more reluctant to say that it's acceptable to criminalize conduct because the majority finds it immoral, being much more concerned about issues about, is there respect shown to other points of view? Is this somehow degrading a minority perspective? And so in that way, I think you certainly did see a strong emphasis on morality in Justice Scalia's jurisprudence, but one where he didn't in the end, have an overall impact on the final direction of the majority.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number, we have time for a few more phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us now who are talking about the legacy of Justice Antonin Scalia. Garrett Epps, contributing editor for The Atlantic, his latest book, American Justice 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. Robert Shapiro, dean of Emory Law School, previously Associate Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at Emory University, and he was a clerk in the Supreme Court and had a chance to have some interaction with Justice Scalia, his dynamic, as he writes about it, interaction with the clerks. And we're welcoming calls. And later on, in just a little while, we'll be speaking with an associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore who will take us through this, what has become very complicated process of getting a replacement for Justice Scalia and political process. She will guide us through that. To David next in Ironwood. Hi, David.
Yes, I think his decision on Cincinnatus was one of the worst. And the fact that, you know, I have a 401k, and I own stock in some of these corporations, and yet these corporations turn around and use it, making political contributions with two parties I do not agree with, literally using my money against myself. And why didn't Scalia put that into the decision, you know?
Garrett.
Well, I think it's important to realize that Justice Scalia actually didn't write the majority opinion in Citizens United, he wrote a concurrence. But that is really the operation of the conservative majority on this court. They are very firmly committed to it. In other words, you could not regard it as a project of Justice Scalia's, they basically heard the argument that the caller made and dismissed it, you know, explicitly. They just said, well, you know, he will have to somehow use the mechanisms of corporate democracy to influence that. No one can quite figure out what that means. But it's very important, you know, even though Scalia symbolized for most people judicial conservatism in the late 20th and early 21st century, he actually didn't do it all himself. For that reason, you know, you can expect his legacy to live on in the current court, because they're four very strong conservatives who remain.
Mm-hmm. What were both of your thoughts? Say, people now are at the point where they say, "Oh, I was doing this Saturday afternoon when I read this, and my mind went here or there." What did you think? Did you immediately think there would be huge political ramifications to all of this, and everything would be up in the air, Professor Shapiro?
I have to say, certainly, when I first got the news, I was shocked. But seeing that Justice Scalia had participated in oral arguments, and he seemed to be very vibrant and dynamic and engaged, I do have to say that I'm a little bit surprised at the tremendous political outpouring which was given rise to by this. I suppose it makes sense given his position, but it is interesting for me, being someone who tends to look at justices within the context of the Supreme Court and the opinions that they write, to see that Justice Scalia also had such an outsized influence beyond the bounds of the court and on society as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Garrett?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that if you knew Justice Scalia, you know he liked to be the center of attention, and he certainly, for better or worse, he managed to leave this world in such a way that he will continue to be for quite a while. As for my reaction, I was in the middle of assembling IKEA furniture, and I have to drop what I'm doing and write something in the next 2 hours. So I didn't really have much chance to feel, you know, I was so busy pulling together a tribute to him. But afterwards, I was surprised that I was surprised. I mean, we are talking about the death of a 79-year-old man. I sit in the court almost every time there's argument. He did not look good to me. He had not looked good for a couple of years, his color, his posture. He seemed a little confused on the bench. You know, clearly had aged from his prime, and yet the man's personality was so vivid. And as Robert says, he was engaged and still very much the center of attention that it just never occurred to me that he might. You, what do you mean die?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
He's Scalia.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much. I hope that you're going to be continue writing as whatever process unfolds in coming up with a nomination and a confirmation process. It's going to be fascinating to watch. But thank you so much. You were great guests. I hope that furniture got put together just fine and you like it.
Oh, I'll finish it any day now.
Oh, it's not done yet. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you very
All
much.
Right.
Our thanks by Garrett Epps, contributing editor for The Atlantic, teaches constitutional law and creative writing for law students at the University of Baltimore. His latest book is American Justice, 2014, Nine Clashing Visions on the Supreme Court. And we also thank Professor Robert Shapiro, Dean of the Emory Law School. Both of them have written about Justice Scalia. We're going to talk about the path forward in just a moment with Karen Myers Morrison, Associate Professor of Law who teaches evidence and criminal procedure. She served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Eastern District of New York, and she prosecuted international narcotics traffickers. She's written an interesting piece about what the four steps are now to a Supreme Court justice who will replace Antonin Scalia. She is at Georgia State. I think I misspoke earlier. She's at Georgia State University. So we'll be with her momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now to talk about these four steps to appointing a Supreme Court justice is Karen Myers Morrison, Associate Professor of Law at Georgia State University. Karen, hello, and thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
So who'd have thunk we're going to have all that's going on now after the death of Scalia? Did you? Did you immediately think, oh, my gosh, what a mess I had?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
Again, somewhat. I mean, with any reflection, I should have known that it would be an enormous mess ahead. But, no, my first reaction was just, oh, my God, I wasn't expecting that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, needless to say, as soon as, the Republican presidential nominees, prospective candidates started saying, we're not going to consider it, whoever
right.
it is. Then I realized, oh, this is going to be ugly and long drawn out.
Yeah. Do you get a sense today that things are changing a wee bit, that there Grassley is hinting that maybe he will have hearings for the Senate Judiciary Committee, that people are saying, well, maybe we'll listen?
Yeah, there's a little bit of, I get the sense that there's a little bit of softening in the tone from some Republicans, and it's not quite the monolithic, everybody falling into line and saying under no circumstances will we consider a nominee put forward by the president. So I think there'll probably be hearings and maybe even a vote, but it's going to be difficult, especially if certain senators want to filibuster it. It could be very long enough.
Yeah. So why doesn't the president tell me, because I find this just kind of intriguing. He's got a little while now where he could do a recess appointment. He could just say to everybody, I know this is really hard for you to do. It's a political year. We're voting for the president. You don't know about who the new president's going to be, the makeup of the court. It's an important thing. So I'm just going to do a recess appointment, find somebody who's terrific, and then the new president can decide who it's going to be at the end of 2017. What's wrong with that?
Well, I just think, in some ways, I think that it's an appealing argument because you could argue that the opposition couldn't hate him any more than they do already. So, they already think that he's doing an enormous executive power grab. So they would just be like, well, we told you so. Mm-hmm. I think his concern is probably losing the high moral ground because it would be pretty quick to be able to nominate somebody this week. There'd be a little bit of a scramble. I mean, no doubt he's had people in mind. He probably has a short list, but it would seem fast, and it would seem very deliberately trying to circumvent the Senate. And, maybe he will come to regret that he's going to try to do it the proper way. But there was one other thing, though, that I was thinking about in terms of the recess appointment. He could do a recess appointment, but then there's a possible loophole that the Senate could come back and then declare that their session is over and say that there's another recess, and then the person's commission under the Constitution would expire at the end of the next session of the Senate. So it's not at all clear. I mean, let's say he did appoint somebody. as a recess appointment. And then the Senate came back and said, okay, in 3 days, our session's over, so your person is out. There probably would be litigation, right? I mean, the recess appointee isn't going to just step down. So there probably would be litigation, and then who would probably end up deciding it?
The Supreme Court.
Of course. Which would still be possibly deadlocked 4-4 because the appointee would have to recuse themselves, and the whole, you know, it'd be sort of like a never-ending hall of mirrors.
Right. So let's say he does nominate somebody. Now we've got the Senate Judiciary Committee, who is Republican, 11 Republicans and 9 Democrats.
That's right.
You say that they have a pre-hearing, but can they refuse to even consider the candidate? Is that what Grassley is saying? He will consider, but they were saying earlier we wouldn't even consider talking about the candidate?
Well, I think what they can do, which I don't think has happened maybe ever, and certainly not since the late 1800s, is they could not report out the nomination. So they get to do 3 things when they receive a nominee from the president. The first thing is they do a pre-hearing investigation. The second is they hold hearings, which are the things that are, you know, broadly televised and you know, end up being fodder for lots of editorials and such. And then they basically come out with a recommendation. Then they report, so-called, their recommendation to the full Senate, which, you know, generally is either, you know, this is a favorable recommendation, you know, we advise confirmation, or if this is a negative recommendation, or we are not issuing a recommendation, but decide as you will. Mm. What they can do is they can refuse to report, technically, if a majority of the Judiciary Committee opposes confirmation of the nominee. It could basically die in committee and never come out of committee. But I don't, that would again be, you know, unseemly, and, you know, it would probably look bad in an election year or any time, really, to do that. So I think the chances are it will go through the hearings, it will somehow land on the Senate floor, and then I really am in no I don't think anybody can really predict what's going to happen.
Yeah. So when can there be a filibuster?
Well, it can be filibustered once it gets to the Senate. So let's say it does come out of the Judiciary Committee. There's been hearings. You know, they're at a minimum going to send it out, maybe with no recommendation, and possibly with a negative one. Then what has to happen is there's the Senate has 2 different types of session, a special executive session, which is where they can consider votes on appointments. Or they're in a legislative session. So if they're in it's already complicated to get into an executive session because the majority leader has to ask for unanimous consent to turn into that.
Mm-hmm.
So if that doesn't happen, then somebody has to move that the nomination be considered. And then depending on what type of session the Senate was in at the time that motion is made, the motion itself could possibly be filibustered.
Hmm.
So if the motion to nominate and to consider the nomination is made during an executive session, then the motion to basically even have a vote could be filibustered. If it's made during a regular legislative session, then the nomination would normally be considered, and then the actual vote itself could be filibustered. Mm.
From what you're seeing right now, Professor Morrison, do you have any idea what route we'll be following? Do we know at all or not?
I don't think we do know. I suspect that the nomination will come out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that the real fight will happen with certain, you know, the more extremely anti-Obama senators trying to filibuster the vote. And once there is a filibuster, as you know, they need 60 votes to close debate and move on to an actual vote. And I don't think, I mean, unless a certain number of Republicans decide to you know, vote to close debate, then, you know, there won't be a vote.
Mm-hmm. So,
because as you said before, there's only 44 Democrats in the Senate and 2 independents.
Yeah.
So they need quite a few.
So could you see Senator Ted Cruz, who might find this enormously politically advantageous, leading a filibuster?
Oh, absolutely. I think he's already promised to dust off Green Eggs and Ham. And, well, I don't know if he really promised that. But, yeah, I think he's already promised to filibuster any nomination. So I think that there will be at least the beginnings of a filibuster. I mean, none of us have a crystal ball, obviously, but it seems likely. Certainly, if Senator Cruz finds it advantageous to, you know, invigorate his campaign or something like that, I would imagine he'd start. Whether the rest of the Senate really wants to put up with that, I don't know. Then I guess we would really see how unpopular he is among his colleagues.
Yeah. And what about all of us? What do we want? It seems to me as though we want this process to be carried forward, right? Have a vigorous debate, that's good. But do we want to wait a year? Do we know if we want that or not?
I wouldn't think so. I would imagine, now I'm just guessing, but I would imagine that most people would want there at least to be a vote. Like, they would at least want to see the government functioning as it's supposed to. That is, the president should nominate somebody because that's his job. It's stated in the Constitution. He shall nominate. And then with advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint. So that's his job. He's got to do that. And I think people will be, more people than not, I would imagine, will be irritated if there isn't even a vote. Of course, the further down the partisan line you go, maybe some people would rather see it all tied up in committee or in
right.
filibuster because, you know, they're thinking about the end result and they don't want a third Obama nominee.
Yeah.
But I don't know, but I can't help but thinking most people would want it to be decided on the merits.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have time for a couple phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The four steps to getting a new Supreme Court justice, and they are fraught with problems, as everybody well knows, is what we're talking about this part of the show with Karen Myers Morrison, associate professor of law, teaches evidence and criminal procedure, and she is at the Georgia State University. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, and we go to Dan in Boulder Junction. Hi, Dan.
Good morning or afternoon. I think I heard the president say yesterday that he had 14 or 17 nominations that had received unanimous approval from the Judiciary Committee earlier that are now held up at this time. Some of those must have been for an appointment to a lower federal circuit court. Why doesn't he just nominate one of them and see if the Senate or the Judiciary Committee wants to go back on their previous word, or the Senate wants to ignore the previous vetting of the Judicial Commission? And I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Dan.
Well, it would seem to me that even if they had, approved unanimously a person for, say, a court of appeals position, realistically I'm losing my words. I mean, to say, it seems fair enough that they would want to go back and hold hearings again and re-vet the person for a very different position, which would be the Supreme Court. That is, I think that they could genuinely say, we need to take another look at this with this other point of view, with this other potential appointment looking to be considered. On the other hand, I'm not sure that one of the people that have been put forward who are still waiting for a vote are really the best bet. There's been some talk about some more recent appointees to the Circuit Court of Appeals, particularly in D.C., who've received a 97-0 vote in favor, that mm-hmm. maybe that would be a good person to put forward as a potential Supreme Court nominee because they were seen as, perfectly acceptable to everybody. But again, there's the counter argument that this is a different position and maybe different values apply.
Yeah. And just, I don't know if you know a yes or no to this. It's all the time we have for an answer. We're almost out of time. Jane asks, didn't Senator Obama try to filibuster George Bush's nomination of Samuel Alito? Do you know?
I wish I do not know off the cuff. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't either. Well, Jane, thanks for the question, and we'll find out the answer. We'll all scurry to the internet. Thank you so much.
Well,
we'd like to be in touch with you again. we'll see what's going on. All right, thanks.
All right, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Professor Karen Morrison, Associate Professor of Law at Georgia State University. And thanks to Scotty Myers for assembling a really good panel of people to talk about the legacy of Justice Antonin Scalia and also what in the world happens from here. We thank Garrett Epps and Robert Shapiro for being with us as well. And thanks, everybody, for all of your interesting and intelligent questions. News is coming up, and we'll return for another hour.